So I want to end by emphasizing something that I think is the key to what has been going wrong, why we've got that downturn. And this is the very significant differences that result depending on who is making the investment and where. If an outside investor comes in and wants to put a factory in a particular area, they're only going to do so if it's profitable for them. They're only interested in the 10% or whatever it is that they make on the total turnover. And if that 10%, that little bit of cream on the top is not there, then the project doesn't start. If we are investing on behalf of our own communities, though, if we want a business set up in our area, there are many, many ways that we can invest and say bang to the profit because we can gain benefits in other ways. So although it would be nice if a profit emerged, if it generates a lot of income streams in our community, we may be prepared to accept a very low rate of return on our capital, or even in certain circumstances, no return at all. For example, if I get a job out of the project, or my children do, or my neighbor's children do, and consequently don't become criminals, and so the crime rate falls, or if my business gets work as a result, as a subcontractor to the new enterprise, or there's a general increase in prosperity, my business picks up as a result of that, then that's one way that benefits can come back. But this requires, I mean, I wouldn't be prepared to invest in that company unless I was living very locally and could capture some of these social as well as economic benefits from it. So the outside investor is anxious to minimize all these other benefits, all the other incomes that a project can generate, because he or she will see that these are coming out of their own profit performance. Or consider the nature of jobs. If we collectively were setting up an enterprise in which we thought we might work, or people connected with us might work, we would want to make the work within that as interesting and fulfilling as possible, because people spend a lot of their time at work. This is one of the ways that they express themselves. What's the attitude of an outside employer? Well, you de-skill as much as possible so that you can hire the lowest cost labor and the least trained labor available. So you tend to mechanize more than perhaps a community-owned business would do. Or consider, say, environmental matters. If you as an outside investor do anything more than the bare legal minimum, then you're adding to your costs. And this is going to make you less competitive. So that's all you do. But if we were living in the community, then we would be thinking about ourselves and our children. And we would want very much higher levels of environmental protection. Or, again, the type of project and the life of the project. Quite typically in British industry, they're seeking a payback period. They're seeking to get their capital out within 3 or 4 years. Because world markets are changing so rapidly, you can't look further ahead than that. In a community project, however, we want to do really vital things, like raising a family. We need to see a 20-year life expectancy of the business before us. So it would be an altogether different type of business going for different markets. And we would tend to go for markets where we had some control. And so we would be looking very much at our own. So this is one of the reasons why the present investment system that allows people to move their money all over the world, wherever they can get the highest monetary return, and yet ignore the whole range of benefits, in fact, and try to minimize the benefits that investment could bring. That's why the present system is bringing such bad results. So what we want to do is to set up a system that enables our money, the savings of this community, to be invested in this community within a 10 or 20 mile radius where you can get some benefits from it in non-monetary terms. Don't allow, for example, your pension fund, just because it thinks that it can get an extra 2 or 3% interest by investing in South America or wherever it might be, to do that, because it could be undermining the quality of life of this community, and in fact, be a false economy, costing you far more in the long run. So, in conclusion, the only way I think that we can build a safe, sustainable society is not from the top down. It's not by international regulations. I don't believe that because of the pressures that business would put on governments to allow cheating, that regulations to control the way that firms, multinational companies act, are really going to provide us a sustainable future. We should be pushing for those changes from on top, but we shouldn't rely on them. What we need to do is to look at what we can do in our own communities to isolate ourselves, to give us the protection that our governments have stripped from us, and to build up ourselves, our families, our neighborhoods, with the resources of our own areas. And if we can do that over the next 10 years, if we can show our politicians that there is another way, that this is safe, that this is far more satisfying than this incessant high-pressure competition on world markets. I mean, why should we compete on world markets anyway? If we can show that this is a more popular, more satisfactory solution, then we can begin to see the changes coming from the top that will allow this sort of system to spread much more generally and to become so well-established. So, thank you very much indeed.
Okay, the first question I was asked, people are still going to want their Nike shoes and their California oranges or whatever it is. And that's true. And there's no reason why they shouldn't get them if there is the currency for them to do so. There would be two currencies, essentially, in circulation. There would be the local currency, which would be used for local transactions, and any firm that had local costs would be able to sell for the local currency, and this would give it an enormous advantage over firms from outside who had all external costs and had to insist on the national currency, because the national currency can become scarce. But the local currency, because it stays circulating in the local area, can never be scarce. And so if you had the foreign currency, as you might say, the national currency, to buy your Nike shoes, then you could buy your Nike shoes, which ties up with another question that I was just asked, the penultimate question I was asked, how radical, what place is there for the wealthy? Do I see sort of social disorder fighting in the streets breaking out over this? Certainly at this stage, no, because anybody who is doing this sort of thing doesn't have the authority of law behind them. They can only do it by consent. A business that is producing for the local markets can't compel people to buy its products. It has to be able to match on price or service, or just because they're easier to buy because they're buying them for the local currency. The second questioner mentioned that there was a plethora of currencies in Latin America already, and that Europe was going over to a single currency. Europe is going over to a single currency, yes, but primarily for political reasons, not for economic, and certainly not for social reasons. And there is evidence that some of the civil servants in the European Commission are getting, in fact, very concerned about the effects that this could have, because it could mean that large areas of Europe become denuded of currency. It's been spent out of it, and so the people can't interrelate. And so they are now beginning to put research funds into local currency systems of various sorts. So Europe might get an overall currency, but there is also the project for the Europe of the regions. And it seems to me very likely that Scotland and Wales will shortly have their own independent currencies at a governmental level. But then there will be other sub-currencies. I can see the situation arising in the future that a community will have many different currencies for different purposes. Some will be for trading, and some will be for saving. Some will have a built-in guarantee of value because they could represent so many units of power. So let's say an alternative energy system is setting up, it could pre-sell some of its energy. Say that in a year's time, you can use this to pay your electricity bill. And those units could circulate as currency, because in an inflationary situation, if such arose, they would have a guaranteed value. They would be backed by the ability of this company to deliver in the future. The World Banking System. The World Banking System is created on debt. All the money that's, with a very small exception, that is in circulation in the world today is the product of debt. If you have money in your pocket at present, you only have it there because either you borrowed it to put it into circulation or somebody else did. And this constitutes one of the major subsidies to the international banking system. They are controlling the units that we need to trade amongst ourselves. So this is true in Ireland as elsewhere. And it's one of the unanswered questions of the century as to why governments borrow from banks who have created currency purely by bookkeeping entries. Why don't governments create their own funds?
The answer to that is no. You asked a question.
I said, why don't they create their own spending power? Yes.
The reason that they give is that their currencies would devalue if they did it.
Yes, but in fact, that seems to be a bogus reason. In fact, it would be easier for them to police the system and only allow an adequate amount of currency to be in circulation. There's an underlying agenda there. What size of local economy do I see? In fact, there will be all sorts of sizes for all sorts of reasons. They will be like the nesting Russian dolls. But the basic unit I mentioned in short circuit is, in fact, the circulation area of your local newspaper. Your local newspaper editor has found by trial and error over time the sort of spatial limits of the area in which you are interested in the doings of other people as people, not as axe murderers or whatever they happen to be. And if you have to turn over page after page and you never see a name that you recognize, you never see a place that you visit, you never see a business that you go to advertised, that's a waste for you, it's a waste for the newspaper. And if you can, you will go to a more focused newspaper. And that, in fact, represents your community. And it also shows, because a newspaper exists for it, a certain amount of economic activity there, enough at least to support the newspaper. That's the quick answer on that one. Angie mentioned that the international agenda, in particular the agenda of the multinationals, was to take things perpetually out of the area of local production for local use and to get it traded on a world basis. And we've got to fight against that. That was, in fact, the argument that I was making. And I think it boils down to this, that each generation has to fight for freedom. The price of freedom is eternal vigilance. In this case, it's not that we've got some external military threat that's going to take away our freedom. It's our economic freedom, our freedom to have a choice of work within our communities, not to become a sort of banana republic, just doing a very limited range of things, those things that just happen to be commercial on world markets at a particular time. Not to have the freedom to have small manufacturers, to have diversity, to have the freedom to escape from excessive levels of competition. So this is really what we've got to consider within this generation. If things are getting worse because of the system that has developed, somehow we have got to find a way of opposing it. The final question that was asked was about, are there examples of places that have introduced alternative renewable energy systems? There are, in fact, quite a lot of these. There's a good lot in Europe, which are all detailed in the book. The best example would be the wind guilds in Denmark, which have not only supplied 4% of that country's electricity, but have built the Danish wind energy industry up. Without it, the Danes are world leaders in wind turbines. It just wouldn't exist. And that goes back to six people, three families. It started in 1979 when an architect living outside Aarhus wondered what he could do. Oil prices had risen. Denmark is almost totally dependent on oil
for the generation of its electricity. And it was going to cost him more to heat his house. And so he joined with two of his neighbors. One was the farming family, and one couple were teachers. And they bought a wind turbine, and they put it where two of their properties joined. And then they went and fought the legal battles necessary to get connection to the grid. And they had a political fight on their hands too. But the outcome of all that was that they forced the utility company, and it was only a 20 kilowatt generator. They forced the electricity company to agree to take their power at 85% of the retail price. So it was a way of getting it from their own turbine to their own homes through the grid, and they paid 15% service charge for that. And that opened the floodgates. And now there are 50,000 families in Denmark who have stakes in the guilds. They are essentially cooperatives. And it's extraordinarily easy to get into these. You can, in fact, borrow money interest-free from one of the JAK banks to invest in wind energy there. So Denmark is divided into three zones. One part of Denmark, which is the scenery, is particularly good. Wind turbines are banned from that. Another part, which is less sensitive, only local people can put wind turbines there. And the third is up for grabs. You can have commercial wind farms, or you can have locally owned ones. So a group of people will get together. They'll set up a co-op. Quite typically, they'll pay about $800 Canadian for a share in the co-op, and then they'll borrow another $1,000 from the local credit union or JAK bank. Each one borrows individually. The check from the utility company goes to the bank. It's divided up. And once, as soon as they've paid off for the turbine, they get essentially their power free. They're limited by government. They get those tax breaks in this, and they're limited by government to how much electricity they can get under this system. And so it's become a mass movement, a mass political movement. So that was started just by three families. It can be done. We can really change the situation. And there's lots of other examples of where this has happened.